Good morning. Now, normally this is where you'd be hearing the Strains of the Visions and Sound theme by Ryan Johns. Well, we'll get to that in just a second. This week is the 9th anniversary of the show, and I'd like to thank those that have stuck with me through the bad times and good. It's a pleasure to bring you the show each and every week, and my listeners, are the reason why I do this show. Now, I hope you enjoy this week's show as much as I did producing it. Please note that there may be language in this roundtable that some may find offensive, but there's not like they're swearing like sailors or anything like that, so your discretion is advised. Now, without further ado, here is the 9th anniversary special that I did here for Visions and Sound. Good morning, my name is Rob Daniels, and welcome to Visions and Sound. Now, for those that may not know what the show is about, a weekly movie, TV, and video game soundtrack program that I'm only happy to bring you each and every week here on CKWR. Now, this week marks my 9th anniversary, and I've done various things on various anniversary shows, the Standard Clip Show and the like. In 2005, I was on the air for 24 hours straight, and I'm always looking for new ways to celebrate the milestones of the show. This week, of course, is no exception. This is the first of what I hope to be many roundtable discussions with people who are associated with the film and TV industry, with a spin towards music. I'm very happy to welcome my guests to this grand experiment. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
Please feel welcome.
All right. Well, it's great to have you all here today, and I think we'll start with, we'll introduce director Ashley Byer. Ashley, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, well, I just finished directing my first film, Print, which Austin scored. And I wrote and directed it, and now I'm trying to get it on the festival circuit, and working on other stuff. I'm a Virgo, and I have two cats and a husband.
Why don't you give like a one sentence synopsis of Print?
That's hard. It's a psychological thriller set 90% in one room. With two characters for most of the time lying and psychologically picking at each other. And it's about with themes of pedophilia, artistic selfishness, male prostitution, and the mutable nature of truth.
Okay, well, let's take a little bit of a moment and have a little bit of a listen to Austin's music from Print.
Thank you.
Okay, so my next guest in the studio here is Amin Metalka. And Amin, talk a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm my film is Captain Abu Rayyad. It's my first feature film. I've done a bunch of shorts before that. And my first collaboration with Austin was on my thesis film at AFI, which was called Morning Latte. But Captain Abu Rayyad is a Jordanian film about an airport janitor who influences kids in his neighborhood who think he's a pilot, an older guy who can make a difference in some kids' lives. And it opens theatrically in a platform release around the U.S. in starting July, and August opens New York, and, you know, just keep an eye out for it, Captain Abu Rayyad.
Okay. Well, here's just a little bit of the music from Captain Abu Rayyad. Okay, next is director Alex Renarvello. Okay, yeah. So Alex, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I just finished Knuckle Draggers, which is my first feature. I'd also done a few short films beforehand. And Knuckle Draggers, the reason for the title is the theme of the film is that when it comes to dating, we have not evolved. And the film follows Ethan, this nice guy who gets dumped by his fiancée. And so, desperate to get her back, he basically, what's called, asks his older brother Kyle to, what's called, to help him with women, and his brother's a total misogynist pig. And he goes from there.
All right. Well, let's have a little listen to the score to Knuckle Draggers. Okay, next we have Paul Soilet. And Paul, let's hear what you have to say.
Soilet.
Oh, excuse me, Soilet?
Soilet.
Soilet.
Yes, it's actually Soilet. I'm actually French.
No.
I'm not French. I'm used to being called Soilet. It's amazing when I hear my name gotten correctly. Grace is my film. It's my first feature and the first work I've done with Austin. It's a horror film. It's like a psychological thriller. Sort of a body horror film, and it is about a woman who is 8.5 months pregnant, loses her child in an accident, and makes a decision to carry it to term and deliver naturally anyway. And when she delivers, the baby miraculously returns to life, but not without sinister consequence.
Mm. Sounds interesting, and here's a little bit of the score from Grace.
Thank you.
next in the studio, we have Rob Williams. Rob, how about you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, my latest film is called Make the Yuletide Gay, and it's a Christmas comedy about a gay college student who comes back home to visit his parents for the holidays, and he's not out to his parents, and then his boyfriend surprises him for a visit, and wackiness ensues. This is actually my fourth film, and it's my third one with Austin. He's done the scores for the previous two films, Back Soon and 3 Day Weekend.
Great. Let's hear a little bit of the score. Right, great. And last but certainly not least is the composer tying this whole group of directors together, Austin Wintry. Now, Austin, for those of you that may not be familiar with your work, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I started a passion for film music when I was about 10 years old, when I discovered Jerry Goldsmith's scores, courtesy of my childhood piano teacher named Derry O'Leary. He had asked me what I wanted to learn, and I didn't ever listen to music before that. It was kind of weird that I was even wanting to do piano lessons because I didn't listen to any music of any kind. And so basically I said, well, I don't know what's out there. And so he brought me soundtrack LPs to A Patch of Blue, Patton, and Papillon. And it was one shot, one kill. It was immediately like, all right, that chapter of my life is now figured out. And I guess all I have left to do is try to go find a wife, which I did like 3 years later. and so I've been a very monothematic guy my whole life. And so in any case, I learned to write music in high school in front of my high school orchestra, you know, very old school. It was it was like this bizarre David Raxon education in front of a real orchestra instead of with synths. Went to NYU, went to USC. And just started working, and one by one met all these people. Of this group, I met Paul first because he's my neighbor, and I bet he was essentially the first person I met when I moved to LA when I was geniusly hammering together a bookcase at like 2 a.m, not realizing that the walls are basically novelty items and not remotely sound insulating. And he came down at like 2 a.m. to say, "Hey, nice to meet you. Please shut the fuck up." So a few years later, through Paul, I met Ashley, because Ashley, her fiance is an old friend of Paul's, and they were discussing Paul's movie Grace, and Ashley was just kind of wrapping up print at that point. Rob was the first of these directors that I worked with. I'm trying to remember. I think I was doing the scoring program at USC, and you just emailed the school, right? Is that how we first met?
Yes, that's it. I was trying to remember how we met.
Yeah, I couldn't remember how. Yeah, so Rob just kind of blindly put out a call for a composer for his film Back Soon, and he and I, you know, hit it off, and we did that score. And then Rob is like this machine. He makes a movie every weekend, and so we did another one a short while after that, and then another one a short while after that. And they've all been really different, especially Back Soon from the others. It's been really awesome because they're not musically like anyone else's films really in here. And then around that same time, I also met Amin, because he also, when I was in the scoring program at USC, emailed the program looking for a composer for his AFI film. And so that's how he and I hit it off. And
actually, then, I attended your Back Soon scoring session.
Yeah, Amin's been to basically every session. In fact, I think literally every session that I've had since we met. He was at Back Soon, he was at Grace, of course he was at Abu Rad, he came to my wedding recording session, he came to Super Capers.
But when I saw you with the orchestra on Back Soon, I started thinking, gosh, this is actually doable to get an orchestral score for a small budget. I mean, Captain Abu Rad's a small budget film. I mean, you know, $1.5-2 million budget movie to get a big, you know, ensemble or an orchestra.
Yeah, yeah.
For it. And that's where I started to really dream of, actually, this is doable, I think.
Yeah, Amin is probably the most, of these people here, he's probably the most fanatic about the music side of filmmaking, you know, with bigger soundtrack collection than I've got. Actually, my introduction to Alex is probably my favorite I've ever experienced, because this was just surreal. I was, you know, basically looking for work maybe a year and a half ago or something, and I cold called. I just found a reference to a movie called Deadland on The Hollywood Reporter, and I looked up the director. He seemed like a cool guy. His name was Damon Osteen, and I called him up, and he turned out to be similar to Amin. He's like a huge film music nut, and he and I talked on the phone for like an hour and really hit it off, and he had already hired a composer for his film. But we just seemed to really, like, get along great. So it was kind of like, even though I didn't end up scoring Deadland, he and I, you know, became pretty much immediately buddies. The funny thing was, we never met face-to-face. In fact, only, like, a month ago or less, we...
At the premiere screening.
Skipping the part where he recommended...
Well, yeah, well, so we didn't meet in person. What, were you there?
No.
We,
Amin's keeping an eye on time.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. So right when I was finishing Grace, I get an email out of nowhere from Alex, who's like, "My buddy recommended I call you for scoring my film Knuckle Draggers." And I'm like, you know, who? And he says, "Damon Osteen." And I'm like, "You mean that director that didn't hire me, who I've never met face to face?" And sure enough, that was exactly what happened. It was crazy. I called him and I'm like, "Dude, I have to buy you dinner for a year." I mean, I've never had... That blew my mind. I couldn't believe someone was recommending me who had never worked with me or even met me. It was crazy. It was a huge platter.
You had all your music on your, like, loads and loads of scores on your website that kind of...
Yeah, really, that's true, but still, I mean, it's still kind of a leap of faith, you know, because you can be a decent sounding composer, but be horrible to work with, and there's no way to know that, and so... So, Alex nods very excitedly. Apparently, that's me.
We're all dodging.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's start with the process of actually hiring a composer. How do you as individual directors go about trying to find a composer that you're looking for someone new? But how would you, in general, find a composer to work on your film?
For me, it's simply. Usually you're through friends, you're recommended people, and you know, you check out their websites, listen to stuff, and I usually look for a piece of music that they've done that has some sort of different sound to it that I haven't
you know, exactly heard before. So that I just want to make sure that they're capable of doing stuff that doesn't sound like everything else. So that's what I look for.
I think for me, my experience with Austin is a little different because we were neighbors, and Austin was actually, you know, actively working on Grace 3 years before we shot the movie. So it's really not the usual experience. But I think with any department head, the question I always ask is, how would you tell this story through your craft? You know, and if you have a satisfactory answer to that and can actually show me that, then you're hired.
I think, like any relationship as a director with any of your collaborations, you want to first really enjoy working with that person as much as hope that they could really deliver a music that's not going to distract or take away from the movie, but make it actually a better film. And it's a scary thing, I think, if you don't know that person. And I feel kind of really glad that I found this guy, because music can completely ruin a scene or can completely distract from it. And if you're starting out, kind of your first movie is kind of your baby, and so you're kind of handing it to someone who, I mean, that's kind of one of the things that I was going through before, even though you and I had worked together on Morning Latte. I was really trying to find the right composer for Captain Abu Raed, and I had actually talked with other people in the past, and there were so many different approaches, and it's really terrifying to think that someone can take it in a direction that you will basically have no control over once you're there. And you're also in a time crunch because you have limited resources, limited budget, and you really have to explore what their capabilities are and what styles of music they're able to do. I feel lucky that we were able to actually make the movie better because of the music.
Yeah, what Amin just said is for me, I can say, not to speak for these people since that's directed at them, but what Amin said is for me one of the most important things is to actually have fun while you're doing it, even if it's like a really, like Paul's and Ashley's film, which are both pretty dark, it still needs to be fun, you know, you still need to be, you know, screwing around and having a good time, because frequently, you know, you're working till 2 or 3 in the morning, either emailing or on the phone, or, I mean, Paul spent many really late nights at my studio, and Amin and I remember we're on iChat at like 4 in the morning, the like day of the session, still working on the end credits. And if it's not fun, then it sucks. Then
it's really stressful because it's scary.
Yeah, it's a whole lot. Like, the music is a kind of disproportionate amount on its shoulders compared to a lot of the other departments, you know, because it's like if the editing is weak or if the acting is weak or if, you know, it's a film that has special effects and those don't come across. Every time any one of those things doesn't deliver 100%, then it's like, we need the score to make up for that. And so we end up with so much on our shoulders because we're kind of the last stop before the thing leaves.
And there's not a right or wrong. There's just...
These very, very hard to determine choices. How, you know, these very subjective. Did you guys have anything you wanted to...
Yeah. I guess I'm thinking about what I'm looking for a composer. Is first and foremost is, do they understand, do they get the film and what it's supposed to be? And then do they understand the specific needs that the music fulfills? There were other composers I talked to, and both of them sort of came at it from a very abstract point of view, like saying, well, I'm thinking I'm going to do the score as though it's entirely functioning inside your main character's head. And I was like, okay, that's interesting, but that tells me absolutely nothing. And then when I talked to Austin, he's like, okay, you have a dialogue-driven movie, but you need music to kind of fill out everything. And I said, yeah, that's all I really, that's what I need, you know, don't kind of throw me with all this, like, thematic BS. I mean, you know, Austin could be thinking that he's doing it inside Chase's head, but as a director, I don't really need to necessarily hear that. It's like, what I need to hear is that, you know, this is how I see the music interacting with the film. You know, and then we can get into the fun thematic stuff.
Yeah, that was. I had the same experience. Was like, Austin totally got the script, and when we met about Maxoon, he totally got it and was like playing me bits of things. Is like, this is kind of what I'm thinking for here, and just understood exactly what I wanted
even if I didn't know what I wanted.
Yeah.
So he got it off the page, and you know, so from there, it's just kind of like, okay, yeah, let's use them again and again.
You're also hoping that that person you're going to work with will also be willing to try some things that are new or kind of challenge you on some things, because when you're making the movie, you're editing it, you're so inside it that there's no you lose objectivity. And when the composer comes on board, well, if he comes on board later, then he's kind of a fresh set of eyes that can really make you realize that, no, you're trying too hard here, or you're trying too much, or you, this isn't enough, or, you know, so not only do you have to get the music, but you're also, I think you're also hoping that person can really bring out things that you didn't think about as well.
Yeah, you want an iron sharpens iron situation for sure. I mean, I think particularly in Austin's case, you want somebody that's hungry, you know, like none of us have talked about that yet. And that is something that Austin has in spades, is like passion and a work ethic that is just like, I've never seen a work ethic like that before.
You're pretty exhausted by the time you get to the composer, and you need someone to just kind of drive that last mile to the, you know, really care about the movie.
That's something that I deal with a lot. A lot of directors are so either burned out or right on the fence of burned out when we get to that phase, that I have to become like this cheerleader for their film to make them realize like they are actually doing what they want to be doing right now. Like, they're making movies. That's not something that you do as a fallback on something else. But it can be really hard to remember that you're, like, fulfilling your childhood dream at every stage of it, because it's so intensely stressful sometimes. And so, you know, when I'm starting on the film, I'm just now being hired. I'm like, that's like the most pristine moment, because that's, you know, there's all this potential and there's so many different things we can do, and there's all, you know, it's like this open book, and I'm at my most excited basically right at that opening moment. And it's, so it can be really challenging sometimes when the director is just like, kill me when they walk in the room.
he makes it look easy, and that's really...
Well, so, what's great about Austin also is that he
starting to feel self-conscious here.
He totally listens and takes input. Even when, you know, I don't speak the same musical language he does. So, you know, I'll listen to a piece and be like, did I hear an oboe in that? Can you lose the oboe? And just like something.
And of course it'll be a solo piano.
And random, you know, but it's like, he'll be like, okay, sure. And take it and make it better. And, you know, just, and he always indulges me in my little.
Well, but that goes both ways though, because especially in the case of print and knuckle draggers, like, I did some pretty out there experimenting in the earlier phases of the score. In fact, including recording Amin singing, like chanting gutturally in Arabic and saying very vile things. And it's like hilarious and awesome music. And Alex was like, don't know.
And it went a little far.
It was a little bit much when we cut to the Iranian girl and it goes, Kus! But you know, that's what I like about, you know, that's one of the things that I think all these guys have in common, is that I can say, well, okay, let's just try something crazy. You know, experiments are bound to fail a lot of the time, but let's try it, because we have no idea where that'll lead. God knows on Grace, if we hadn't had that kind of attitude, it would have been a probably really conventional score, and it would have really dramatically made for a different movie completely.
Mm-hmm. So now, as individual directors, do you go into a project with a musical idea in mind? You've mentioned that it's a tough process when you finally get to the composer, but do you have an idea, a musical idea in mind, or you just leave it up to the composer?
Well, this is, if I can just speak, because I think I have a slightly unique thing. My film Print, it's, like I said, it's a pretty much a one-room location film, 90% dialogue. Like Austin pointed out, it almost rests entirely on the dialogue, which apparently is crazy and, you know, innovative, which I had no idea. I just knew I knew how to write dialogue really well. So the thing with that is, when I was writing it and all through the process, I was just like, we don't need music. There will be no music in this film at all. Like, we can just, you know, it'll just rest on two people in a room talking, sitting across from each other. And then, of course, we cut that together, and I was like, it's missing something. So I went in, like, with Austin with absolutely no musical idea whatsoever, and all I just really wanted was, like, please don't drown out the pretty voices. And Austin, to his credit, was insanely patient in, you know, taking this fun little journey with me, skipping along.
Well, that was a unique challenge.
Stringing the voices like that George Bush video where the piano goes with the international voices.
Yeah.
I think it's important it's very important for me to let the whole thing be organic. That's where the magic of filmmaking is. So I try not to be rigid about anything. And again, like, I have like a slightly musical background, but not, you know, not as far as film scoring goes. So I don't really speak that language, but what I do speak and what Austin speaks as well, which is important, is sort of like I can communicate, you know, the emotion and the feel atmospherically of a scene. And sort of the intent, and then, you know, Austin can sort of like build it from there. And at that point, you know, I can definitely say what I don't want, you know, so it's sort of like a sort of reductive thing for me.
Well, and Grace was unique because there was no temp track of any sort. Like there, at least in print, there were a couple moments where there was like some like Shawshank Redemption, just kind of very quietly filling space in the background. And what we ended up with was kind of, I was able to work on it so far in advance and wrote all this music based on the script that we then took to the set and were able to kind of talk about, and I was able to put it on an iPod and put, you know, give it to the lead actress and talk about, you know, and it was that was a completely radically different experience than I'd ever had as far as like what the question was, having a musical idea in mind beforehand, because Grace, not only did we do that, but then there was zero temp track in that film when they cut it together at all. And at one point, for the like executives to be able to watch it and to like submit it to festivals, I guess, Paul asked that I make a temp track, which was, again, something I had never done. So I put together this temp track. It was like a solid day. It was actually, I finally understood why Amin likes doing that, because it was actually really entertaining to take like a few seconds from The Ring and then layer it in and process it with the Basic Instinct playing backwards.
It was
like
a damn good temp track.
It was.
What got Austin hired for Brent was.
Oh, that's right.
Paul showed me and Adam, my fiance, I don't know what cut of print it of Grace it was, but he showed us an early cut of Grace, and we had just lost a composer on print, and all I could think of was like, This temp track is perfect. Who did this? And you're like, oh, my composer. So it was really because of that temp track that
it was nothing fun. More fun than actually temping. Like, put it. I mean, I guess Captain Abura would be the exact opposite of case of Grace, where when I was cutting the picture, when we were cutting in the editing room, just being a big fan of film scores for the longest time, I would immediately hear things in my head, like as we're cutting a scene, and say, oh, I wonder what that. So then I'd go home and come back the next day and just throw on, you know, Thomas Newman's Josh and Sam. And, like, you experiment with things. And things that are sitting in the collection that you haven't accessed in the longest time, and you just start playing music against picture. And so when I gave you the first time you saw the film, which was, like, what, 4 or 5 weeks before recording the orchestra?
Yeah, it was very soon.
Yeah, I showed Austin the cut of the film that was pretty much almost the finished cut. But it had temp score, like, for pretty much all the moments that ended up having music.
There was only one scene that we added. Two scenes. Right. The two conversations with Noor, the car and then on the roof, were the only two scenes that had no temp. And that was actually fun because Amin was like, maybe we should have something here. And I initially was like, oh, no way. And then I started thinking, improvising on the piano just on the fly, and Amin jumped off the couch and was like,
perfect.
Holy shit, let's just go with that. And what's in there is pretty much exactly what I played.
Yeah, I mean, you had a kind of a theme for, not so much a theme for Noor, but like for those two.
Kind of a
anyways,
mini.
Yeah,
kind of a mini.
The movie, I don't wanna, but in general, the orchestra, in our case, we wanted to have an orchestral score for a Middle Eastern movie, unlike what you would normally associate with Middle Eastern films, you would hear kind of an Eastern score. So going in, there was a very clear idea that this was going to be, or the ideal kind of score was to have something that's kind of like a Hollywood score. And so,
yeah, something universal.
Something universal and, you know, and expansive and large, but then at the same time intimate with some solo instruments, and that's what you ended up doing.
Yeah, Abu Rayad was pretty effectively temped. I don't remember what the temp music, if any, was on Back Soon, but we've had...
I don't think there was any.
Was okay. I can't remember hearing anything.
No. And that was, you know, I certainly didn't have any idea going in. But for Make the Yuletide Gay and 3-Day Weekend, those are both very song heavy.
Yeah.
And I went into production already having most of the songs picked out. So it was kind of like,
it's kind of a quasi temp.
You basically need to work with these songs. So by the time you got a cut, Make the Yuletide Gay had 7 original songs in the film, plus Christmas carols that were being sung and all of the stuff. And so you basically had to work around that, which is probably backwards from what it should be. But
no, it worked great. I mean, it's because it's better that you would pick a song that you like and that you go with, and then I calibrate my approach versus me writing some music and you trying to find some song that would go with that. That would, I would imagine, be far more difficult, especially if I wrote anything remotely kind of left field. You know, you're immediately leaving the pop music world. So I guess, yeah, there wasn't really temp in the traditional way. I remember there were a couple of temp cues on Yuletide that were, like, not, like, appropriate at all.
Yeah.
And we both were like, yeah, can we agree that we hate these?
Yeah.
And we were and like, was, yes, and we moved on.
Like, we needed to put something in for a film festival submission. And I was like, okay, let's just grab some public domain Christmas carol and put it in. And just like, wow,
that is awful.
That's wrong. That's not it. Yeah. So when you do this score, don't do that.
Yeah, and then but there was also kind of like Abu Ghraib, there was pretty traditional, pretty effective temp and knuckle draggers also.
For me, it's called like how clear an idea I have in my head of like of what the music will be for a project really depends on the project. I've actually done more like suspense thriller type stuff in the past with my short films. And so I had, for those, I had very clear ideas of, like, the style of music I wanted or, you know, style score. But for Knuckle Draggers, it's a dialogue-heavy romantic comedy. And so for that, I was a little more open. I had that Wedding Crashers piece as a temp that...
Yeah, like 8 times.
Yeah.
it was like this one cue, which I now just think of as like the prototype Knuckle Draggers. Like, yeah. When I see Wedding Crashers on TV, it's like on in the other room, and I'm like, what the fuck? Like, I think someone's watching Knuckle Draggers as an instinct. And
but as far as the score, I think I was pretty open to, like...
Oh, yeah.
What's called to, you know, to what to do. And, I mean... and. There's a couple pieces we battled over, but there's also, I remember, there's like 2 pieces where your first pass is pretty much...
Yeah, the batting cages, I didn't change 1 note from the first pass.
Yeah, there was also the lunch money scene early on,
uh-huh.
Where like we just tweaked 1 tiny thing, but...
Yeah, and it was always subtle, but we battled in the best of ways, because you know, they're such delicate scenes, this film. It's so dramatically, like, it's...
My favorite day was when I called you after you locked everything. I'm like, you know, dude, we need to change that bar scene a little bit. And
I know, of course, I'd already delivered the music. The music had already been mixed. You know, the movie's like practically, you know, I mean, it's for all intents and purposes done. And like done, I basically did print in the entirety of the time between when we were supposedly done with Knuckle Draggers from when I came back and refinished Knuckle Draggers. But I have to say, like, I think everything that's in there is great. I really like the alternate version of the bar scene that is there musically, because it's really fun, this combination of, like, very romantic, ultra-romantic Spanish guitar with all this heavy caveman drumming. And so I love it as a piece of music. But I really like also the version that ended up in the film, which is just pure, straight percussion, and it has almost more of an animal attitude and none of the ironic Spanish romantic guitar. And it works great. So it's one of those things... I try to really make it a point to not, if I get into a disagreement with a director over a cue, I try to make sure that whatever we wind up with is not something that I feel sucks. Like, no matter how much I have to compromise, it's important to me that I find something in there that I really feel great about. Like, because, you know, in my earlier days when I was doing short films left and right, you know, I hadn't really learned that lesson yet, and so I'd do a scene, and then the director would ask for change, and I'd feel like, oh, that really hurts the music. But I wouldn't challenge him on it, and I would just let it go, and then I'd be sitting there at the screening and be, like, shrinking down into my seat. And then invariably, they wouldn't call me again. You know, I feel like I'm not doing my job unless I play devil's advocate, especially when I feel really strongly about something. I mean, like, Abu Rad has an example of that with the with the end credits where Amin...
Don't give away the ending.
No, just the end. I won't. But the end credits of the film. There are two moments in the film where Amin... No, he actually does the split screen with the face and freeze frame while he says their name. But there were two, the beginning of the end credits and then also a very pivotal scene that's kind of the emotional climax of the film where Amin basically wanted it scored gigantically. Okay. And in both cases, I fought him and ended up convincing him to do the opposite and score it I went from full, huge, rich, ridiculously over the top, like Ben-Hur orchestra to solo cello. In fact,
that one of those scenes, talk about like the stairs, there's a scene, there was a scene when we were shooting it, it was a crane shot. It was a big crane shot, slow, but kind of a big crane. I was thinking, this is, as we were filming the shot, just this one long cinematic, very nice, beautiful cinematic shot, I was thinking, this is going to sound very big, and it's actually exactly the opposite of what it ended up sounding. And again, it's that moment of objectivity that you bring to it, which is, no, here we need to be kind of sinking in emotionally, like taking in the emotion that had led up to this moment. And so we bring down, like, let the music not force, bully its way into the audience, but let them bring their own reflection into the scene. Okay. And that's...
Yeah, so a lot of directors, I'm not including you in any of this, have been accused of what's known as temp love. Why do you think that happens?
You just, out of habit, I guess. I mean, if you get, you just hear something over and over again, and then you hear something new for the first time, the familiarity, sometimes hearing something new after you've been sitting with something that's just so familiar, you're like, especially if it's pretty different, you know, I mean, I had that sense of, wait, what the heck? This is completely different than what I had. So, I mean, that's where I could see temp love coming in, although I hated my temp, you know, again, dialogue-driven movie. There's really absolutely nothing you can do. There was one temp track where we literally, like, took 3 seconds of a piece from Lady in the Water and just looped it.
Yeah, for like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was one of those where I was like, I'm very confident I'm going to be able to write something better than this.
Well, the thing is, sometimes the temp can really become, like, really hit a mark, and when you watch the movie, like when you're cutting and you're kind of doing all this experimentation later, if it hits it, you really get stuck to that idea.
Yeah.
But you can love the temp, but then you have to accept there will be a point where you have to, like, it's like a new phase when you take the temp out and replace it, and the movie becomes its own identity, finally.
It's like taking off the training wheels.
Yeah.
I really try to avoid using a temp. I mean, the only reason we temped Grace was because we had to submit early to a film festival.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, like, if a scene can't work without music, and ideally music just elevates a scene. If a scene does not work without music, you fucked up. You didn't do your job.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
so
yeah.
I really won't temp anything unless it's like for, you know, a meatball executive that needs everything spelled out, or for a festival.
Yeah, I would say none of these guys have issues with temp love, and I've dealt with that, like, to the worst possible degree, where literally a director went and looked up what the legal limit of how close you can get to something is before it counts as copyright infringement, and asked me to do that very specifically as legally defined. And, you know...
Wow.
The best directors, I think, are the very best directors, which I think all of these people in here would fall under the category of, are people who can very effectively temp a film. Like, they can put in music that works and then have no trouble re-envisioning it from that point forward. Because what that means is that they're able to see their film from multiple perspectives and really... Because the thing is... You put in this really glorious temp, and it's not like the, because then the question always becomes, so how do I write something that's as good or better than this? And so the way I've always thought of it is, I try to write something that's very different from that, and not try to think in terms of better or worse, because it's if you try to do the better version, like I remember when I was at USC, someone we had to score a scene from an existing movie, and one of my classmates rescored a scene from GoldenEye, and the guy who was teaching the class basically said, "Do you anticipate you're going to be able to out David Arnold, David Arnold? Are you going to write a better James Bond score than David Arnold?" And the guy was like, "Well, no." And he was like, "Then why are you wasting your time?" So, you know, it was like that was like this epiphany where I was like, "Yeah, absolutely, that's right. You should completely reinterpret it and start essentially from scratch and use the temp to look at the dramatic beats that are being highlighted and look at it for what its function is and not try to be like, oh, I see. They want oboe with strings on the third of the chord followed by, because it's not nearly that. With the best directors, it's not like that. It's not what they're looking
for. But sometimes that's kind of the responsibility of a director to accept that you cannot... It's called the temp because it's temporary. And
exactly. Yeah. Well, that's why I say it's the best directors that I can say that of.
Yeah,
I've worked with some that I had to really kind of find my voice within a style of music that was very set in their mind, and it becomes very difficult to do that. And but at the same time, I actually encourage temps a lot because, as I'm sure all of you would attest to, basically directors don't know how to communicate musically. It's usually the only way to effectively talk. Even if it's like on Rob's film, it's a way of saying very much what we don't want versus what we do want. It's still worth its weight in gold, I think, most of the time. But, you know, it's a way, it breaks down the communication barrier, which is usually very, very rock solid otherwise.
I remember actually when I was trying to, figure out print, as Austin says, which I think is very accurate, which is I started out wanting one thing and then it completely evolved into me wanting the complete opposite or something totally different. But I remember when I said, it kind of hit on me, epiphany-wise, I was like, okay, Austin, listen to Silence of the Lambs. That sort of, like, after that moment, like, that cracked it open. Like, that then became our kind of, that sort of, I felt like it wasn't like a huge wall was up between us, but I think there was, like, a retaining wall at our shins, and the Silence of the that we couldn't step over because there were monsters on it. I don't know.
Barbed wire,
yes. Mace.
No, that's actually, I forgot about that, but you're absolutely right. I remember I had tried as an experiment to score the really long interview scenes that are like literally dialogue with barely even like cutting. It's very just pure performance. It's almost like theater. I had tried scoring it. I thought, okay, as an experiment, I'm going to score this extremely energetically. So I wrote this like concerto for cymbal, where it was like this incredibly busy piece of music over this dialogue, and it was really cool and interesting. But we were both like, "This isn't right." It's like as a scene on its own, it's fine, but it really makes this scene like this blinding neon sign in the film. And it also was a little bit incongruous, but it was really like a valuable experiment. And then she was like, "You should go watch Silence of the Lambs again." And I was like, "What the fuck?" So I go and I watched it. Just felt like time to see it again anyway. And even though the score is nothing like that, it was like I totally, without saying anything, and there was no temp and musically and thematically, like there's absolutely nothing in common. But how that music functions in the film and the way that it kind of breathes in a very sort of that uniquely Howard Shore way of like, is it underscore or is it just kind of like wallpaper? It's like this halfway mark between John Williams very carefully scoring along his type versus like Thomas Newman on the opposite extreme where it's basically just kind of there. He's kind of halfway in between, which is a hard thing to really kind of put into words. And I just watched that film and was like, fuck. And I mean, it was like smooth sailing through the rest of the film from there, which is, I totally forgot about that, but yeah.
So has the music composed ever, like you come into a project, you shoot your film, you have a specific look that you're going for, but has the music composed ever changed your perspective on the scene you shot?
Well, I think in the case of Captain Abura'ed, there were two ways that some of the scenes could have gone, like big or small. And that's exactly what I was just saying earlier. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can see that you can think while you're filming that this scene can be very musical, like musically big, but then the way it's scored can actually be more effective if it's small. And likewise, rhythm in a scene, like the montage, the storytelling montage, You cut a scene, you cut a montage, for example. That is especially a place where kind of the music can really be an essential component. Having one offbeat rhythm versus one kind of like the two different rhythms that they were both fast paced, but one was more kind of friendly, I guess, to
right.
How would you describe it? The two different approaches that we had.
Well, one was a much simpler rhythm.
Simpler. Sometimes less is more, and like simpler is more effective than busy and big and crazy. And
yeah, and I think with Grace as an example, I think that we didn't have any like huge crazy epiphanies along the way, because Paul probably had the most specific vision going into that film of any director I've ever worked with as to exactly what each scene would need. And he just knew intuitively if it was perfect or not. And I always kind of had that gut feeling of like, he's going to have something to say, but I wasn't sure what it would be. So I wouldn't have any idea how to fix it until he gave me notes. But like, 'cause I try to think of scenes that could have maybe been radically differently interpreted, like the birth scene or something. And
well, the sex scene, that was interesting. The opening sex scene.
Right, true. The very, very opening. But even that's still...
They had two different approaches, but that made a difference. Like the... Ding, ding, ding. Remember they had
that's true, that's right. There was almost like a ticking clock.
Yeah. It made the difference having that versus having silence.
Yeah, I guess that's true, but it didn't like radically change perception of the scene.
No. I've absolutely seen like the transformative power of the music. Scenes where I was like, I wanted to eat a gun. Like watching the scene, like I just was. This is fucking this is, how am I ever going to show this to someone? I'm going to eat a gun. Like, I've had people be like,
I pulled it out of his mouth and was like, Paul, safety's on.
This actor was amazing. This performance was amazing, and you're like, you just smile. You're like, that's good. That's good. I'm glad you like that.
I had a scene like that in Back Soon where it was, I'm not going to say which scene, but it's like, I just like would watch it. And it's like, this is the best we can do with the performances, with the cutting and everything. And it's just like, this is going to absolutely kill the movie.
Yeah.
And Austin comes in. And does this thing.
First, he gives you a therapy session. He's like, no, this isn't that bad. And I think that we can.
Yeah, exactly.
And then once the score's in there, it's like, it's pretty much
everyone's favorite scene.
It's everyone's favorite scene because the score is so amazing. If you watch it without the score, you would be like, wow, that's not right.
But it goes beyond just Band-Aids, you know? It actually, I mean, it's very delicate work, like actually massaging specific beats and like... the beats between the beats to set up
bringing
the beats, like
subtext,
really
bringing out subtext,
all subtext. Yeah.
Yeah. See, I had a scene, and I think on the show to show Music from Print, we're actually going to play the piece that Austin wrote, and it's a pretty like intense, powerful, you know, kind of all cards are on the table scene between two characters, and I mean the way it ended up being performed and the way we ended up editing it, it was already just like I'd watch it and be like, oh my gosh, you know, it hits you. And then once, I mean, I was like, I just, at that point, I was like, okay, well, there's no way we could go any further than this. This is perfect. Then when Austin put in this cue for it, I mean, I watched it the first time I saw it with music, like, I wanted to cry watching something that I had watched 1,000 times or more. And even now, like, I mean, you know, it's hard to, like, watch my own film with anybody. But when I get to that scene, it's like I immediately relax because there's something wonderful happening. And I think the music just sort of just pushed it, kind of, I mean, it literally, I just, like, my heart hurts when I watch that scene. And it really has to do with the music. The music kind of just stabs you in the heart, which is, as a director, what you want.
Yeah, I remember telling Ashley, I remember saying, like, we're looking, I'm always looking for that fuck yeah moment from the director where they realize, like, we have a snowball going that's like, and everything's going how it should be, and it's just all momentum from here. And we've figured out all the math problems, and we've got everything in a row, and it's going great. And that was that moment for sure where Ashley called me like,
and he had sent me a text too, and he had sent me a text saying the couch. He said the cue for this couch scene is probably the best I've ever written, And I was just, he was like, no, it is. Just, you know, not even going to try to set you up or.
It was like four in the morning. It was like four in the morning. Cause I remember that, like, the score was going along and there were re-edits going on and discussion with producers and the film was kind of, going along. And then suddenly, it was like, oh, by the way, we need the film finished in 4 days and I still had 25 minutes of music left to write.
We had just gone into a festival and they're like, oh, hey.
Yeah, So I banged through 25 minutes of music in a weekend, and I remember I was doing the thing where I get up at 3 in the morning, and rather than, I like to get up early instead of work late, so I got up at like 3, and I remember texting Ashley, it was like literally 5 in the morning, and that's always so depressing when you do something you're so excited about, and it's that early, because you have to wait like 4 hours for them for them to respond.
I feel like I was awake.
And yeah, well, you may have been. I can't remember what the lag was, but I remember it was freaking early. And I sent you a text. I was like, I think this may be the best scene I've ever scored. And you wrote back.
For a couch,
yeah. Casting couch. No,
that's what happens on the couch, I mean.
Exactly. So I told her, I think this may be the best scene I've ever, like the best cue I've ever done as far as like this marriage of picture and film. And she writes back like, "Well, thank God, because it's the best scene I've ever directed." It's like very much like better fucking be.
This is actually a question that was sent to me by one of the members of the Film Score Monthly board. More recently, films like Hulk and Pirates of the Caribbean have had their score replaced. So when the film's in trouble and the execs are panicking, at what point do you think that the short score should be replaced and a new composer brought in, or should it be done at all?
I think Alex is really the only one with experience on this as far as, because, I mean, obviously none of these people have thrown out my scores, thank God, mm-hmm. But I was not the first composer I know on Knuckle Draggers.
Yeah, I can't really get into that.
Fair enough. Well, then speak in theory.
You know, I had somebody before, and what's called a great guy, got along really well. And we just had just very, very different, ideas, I guess. And different way of working, also, which was a huge thing. And just kind of couldn't mesh. And so at one point, we just decided to call it quits. And it was amicable, so.
It's actually, I was about to answer the question one way, and then I just had a little like light bulb go on to my own experience. First off, just to kind of address, like with Hulk and Pirates of the Caribbean, I don't know, because surprise, I never worked on those movies and don't have any intimate knowledge of them. But I feel like for those movies, the execs are panicking and the score gets replaced. There's probably something wrong that goes much deeper than the score. And it's at the last. Right. It's at the kind of the last
the best,
thing.
The best
and
then, or the worst example of that is what happened to Gabriel Diarra's score to Troy, which was an incredible score and ended up being replaced by a 10-day score schlock job by James Horner that's not inspired, and it's outrageous. I thought it was one of the most, and it was all based on a focus group of 17 people who teenagers who fit a demographic that they were trying to appeal to.
Yeah.
And that was the most ridiculous. Gabriel spends a year writing an amazing score.
And a score that was on a level unlike he'd ever really had the opportunity to do before,
Incredible, massive, beautiful score. Mm-hmm. It just gets replaced. It's not artistic sometimes. It's just panic. Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, I think that was an example of exactly what Ashley's talking about. They were reacting to less than favorable reviews of the movie in general, and at that point you can't recast it, you can't reshoot it, you can't really re-edit it.
It's like you were saying, the score's the last stop.
Yeah, it's the easiest thing to change.
Did something like that happen on Die Hard? Isn't there some last minute something on that one?
On Die Hard, they used aliens in the last cue. They kept the temp piece when Reginald Val Johnson shoots the German guy.
Yeah.
And they kept the piece from Alien, and they kept the piece from Man on Fire, the John Scott score. But everything else was Michael Kamen.
And that happens a fair amount also.
Yeah, they did that on Kingdom of Heaven. They kept some of the temp score.
They reused Hannibal.
Yeah, well, it's
and,
not even...
The 13th
I mean, yeah,
Warrior.
It's Patrick Gassett, yeah.
They reused there's a beautiful aria from the movie Hannibal that they put in Kingdom of Heaven. I was
they
like,
used,
hey.
Like, twice in Kingdom of Heaven.
Yeah, yeah. They used it twice in Hannibal, too.
They used it 3 times in
Hannibal is not a great movie, but I do love that score. But
yeah,
speaking to, like, just kind of to follow up that question, I mean, I did have, like, a producer call me and kind of tell me that he was concerned about the direction of the score. The thing that, and I mean, at that point, Austin and I was kind of timid to tell Austin, like, okay, I don't like this, but I don't know what I want, you know? But the thing was, I mean, first off, the thought of replacing Austin was never really in my mind, even though we were having problems, and it was my first movie, so I didn't really know how it was supposed to work, how this worked. But the big thing that kept me from doing that, above all, was that I believed in Austin. It was like, and I even said this to producer, I'm like, look, we're having trouble right now, but I believe in this guy, and I know he can deliver, and you better not fire him, you big jerk.
Well, I mean, that was definitely, like, probably the most challenging film I've ever done, because, I mean, it's, how do you, it's like a 50-minute score for two people in a room, you know, it's like, the level of delicacy in how big you get, and how the musical elements of, like, how melodic can you get, how rhythmic can you get, those are all such, like, ultra-fine hairlines on a film like Print. And in Grace, too, although Grace is a little bit broader of a canvas, so it has a little bit wider of a scope that we could evolve in. But, I mean, that was very much like throwing a dart at a target through, like, the target of another dartboard in front of it where the bullseye's been removed, and you have to, like, you know, angle through both. It was an intensely... And I remember having that conversation with one of the producers where he was like, he goes, I think we're trying to make drama and you're scoring a thriller or something like... He said something to that effect. I'm like, oh, okay, that's not remotely instructive feedback, but I kind of get what you're getting at, you know. But again, we were dabbling and experimenting with a lot of stuff, so it was like... That was, you know... But actually, I have to say, I've been really lucky, and especially with all you guys, all your films, that I didn't have that kind of, like, Troy-type situation where someone who was not really creatively involved in making the film suddenly jumped in and started asserting themselves. Like, we didn't... Fortunately, like, on Grace, it was just basically me and Paul the entire time, and you know, like, Adam and Corey and all the other guys. They basically trusted Paul to deliver what he wanted to deliver, and so I got to answer only to him. And on Albuquerque, Pritchard spoke up exactly once, and it was during the storytelling montage, and his note was dead on. And it was like, I was blown away that the executive producer, who I'd only spoken to once ever before, calls me and had a note, and I was like, fuck, he's absolutely right. Couldn't believe it. And then I don't think we had that at all. Well, I guess a little bit on Knuckle Jaggers at the end. Paul Alessi, the producer, had been in Canada on another project during most of the scoring, and then he came back and he had all these thoughts, and so we had to kind of reopen the score in a couple places.
Well, it was mainly one section. The other ones were just really minor little changes.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the same thing. He had thought what he said was good.
Yeah, I do too. You know, it was one of those things where we found...
I can't wait to get to the point of having budgets big enough for this to be an issue. My films are so small that it's like,
yeah,
I make it, and
you do what you want to do.
Well,
that was Print as well.
Well, sort of.
Well, I guess that's,
I mean,
true.
Half and half. Yeah. Well, so I mean, I really do like that question. Whoever sent that from the message board.
Yeah.
I guess in my case, I would say that, like, the point where you would dump the composer is when you, as the director, stop believing in them and stop believing that they can deliver. And if you have a good relationship with that composer, that is never. And if that composer then does get dumped, then it is not your decision. And I would hazard to say, in most cases where the score gets the composer gets replaced, it's probably not the decision of the director. It is probably an executive or a suit or something of that nature, I would say. Because
yeah,
I could never imagine replacing Austin unless he got deathly ill.
Yeah, every now and again you definitely have a situation where a composer seems to genuinely miss the mark. Like on Air Force One, you know, Randy Newman's score is very solid music, but if you watch it to picture, it's not that what that movie was supposed
to be.
Yeah, it makes the movie look like Independence Day was what Amin said. which was so not the right. It scores it like a superhero instead of like this patriotic kind of.
It's Buzz Lightyear, not Air Force One.
Yeah, and so that, but that's an example where it does seem to be just a genuinely different creative direction, instead of a political thing.
Yeah, when the president comes down, it's like, na 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 na.
Yeah, it's very not right.
Oh no, da 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 da. It's like so heroic.
Get it right, get it right. We'll wait.
Da 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 da.
That would have been good.
So what?
Yep, wasn't an office then. Oh.
Ashley, what were you about to say?
I was just going to say, what is the most rewarding part of working with a composer?
The day the orchestra starts, the day you're recording with the orchestra. I have to say, October 29, 2007, were the two coolest days of my life. You've worked
so hard.
He had
a damn good cookie that day.
Yeah, so that's Mrs. Fields' cookies. The day you've worked tirelessly for a year, whatever long length of time, to get this movie from, well, even more than a year and a half, 2 years, from script to screen to editing to scoring, sitting, you know, hours on the, you know, listening to MIDI samples and kind of trying to imagine what the orchestra is going to sound like. And then the day you show, I mean, the day we recorded Captain Aburad was at Warner Brothers, Clint Eastwood's scoring stage, where they had recorded this big, did they record Norman Head there?
I don't remember, big
movies. And here you have an orchestra that's about to record a score that you've been listening to on samples for, you know, the last 3 weeks or whatever, like the time. And then they start playing. They start tuning their instruments, and then they start playing the first cue. That's the biggest goosebumps moment I can ever imagine. And I don't know if it'll always be like this on every movie. Well, I just, Spielberg goes to every Williams
video
session.
Videotapes,
like
he handheld camcorders every John Williams session like a little fanboy.
And that's awesome. For me, that's it's more fun than actually the first day of production, because that's, you're nervous right that day, but lay back and just, you know, watch the orchestra bring the music to.
And Amin is such an orchestra oriented filmmaker, you know. I mean, he listens to this stuff for pleasure, not just as a creative or professional thing, but it's like just in the car he would have this kind of music playing, and so that's why I have to say this. I mean, we've told this story a bunch of times with all the Abu Rad stuff, but for me, just to kind of answer the question from my perspective, off of what Amin just said, was the highlight for me on that whole process was on the first day of the recording session, where I'm conducting the orchestra, and there had been this little sort of melody that I had written for his AFI film, Morning Latte, that was a little piano thing that was a source cue in the coffee shop in that film. That was kind of a parody of the Satie Gymnopédie. And I had done this little piece, and it repeated like one chord for like 10 minutes. And it was like this joke of like this just retarded music, basically. And so I had basically snuck a reference to that into the score.
Into the end credits.
Into the end credits. It's like the end of the end credits for Captain Over Red quotes the score for Morning Latte. And so I'm conducting the orchestra, and then the musicians are just playing it down. You know, to them, it's just the cue. They don't realize anything. So I'm conducting, and I look over my shoulder while I'm conducting the orchestra, and, you know, you look back through the glass in the control booth, and it's like, you know, there's my Pro Tools guy, and then there's my recording engineer, and there's my orchestrator, and there's a booth guy, and then there's, like, a couple friends, my wife. And everybody's sitting there just kind of, like, with that blank expression watching the orchestra. And then it's like my eye pans over to Amin, and it's, you know, you can't hear through the glass. And all I see is, like, him writhing around, just laughing hysterically. And every single person around him has just blank expressions. And you can't hear anything. All I see is this silent spasm. And that, to me, was just the greatest moment, to look back and see his reaction to hearing the score to Morning Latte. It was like such a little, just like inside joke that was so like over and done with that fast. But to me, like, that was the moment that I'm like, I love this process. This is that fun thing that I was talking about where you can't take yourself too seriously because the music is like so intensely dramatic that, we had to be, I mean, of course on that one, we were doing contests with the orchestra
and really have fun.
For me on Knuckle Draggers, I think it took me a second to kind of think about it. My favorite moment was probably the, as you said, the fuck yeah moment when, when we looked at the bar scene one more time. And kind of, what's it called, made those last changes. And then, right there, I was like, this is it. This is how it's supposed to be. And I think that was probably the most rewarding moment for me.
Yeah, and that
it was the last thing. I knew it was like, we're solid, we're good, the score's awesome.
And I kind of went into that one a little bit kicking and screaming because I was like, I think that what we have is so good and it's so original. And
if you could have seen me on the other end of the phone, I was kind of like laughing the whole time because I knew how you'd react. I was like, oh, he's going to hate this.
Yeah, but it works. It works great. I mean, Alex was like, what if, we put in kind of like, there's like all this caveman drumming and then I added in basically like a dance beat, very, very subtly underneath it, and like that was the moment that Alex was like, fuck, this is the scene, like that tiny feather
the
touch.
Other stuff that I wasn't so sure about, once you added that in, it worked, and I was like, that's it, don't change a thing.
Yeah, it was, that was definitely, I love those moments where you feel the director, like, suddenly they go from, because I hate when I get, yeah, this works, this is fine, you know. Yeah, I see where you're going with that. You know, where it's like that's the kiss of death because
that's
it means they're trying to like it.
Interesting. That's what I always tell him. Yeah, I didn't know what to say.
Yeah.
And finally, I was like, okay, I hate it, and he's like, thank you.
Yeah, I would much rather hear that. I mean, Rob and I did like 20 versions of a cue in Yuletide where it would be like, it's good, but it's not right.
There. It's not quite there. It's not quite there. And we kept the whole time was like, we're not going to do a big Hollywood Christmas cue, and it's like, fuck it, do a big Hollywood Christmas cue. And I still don't think that's your favorite cue, but it's like, it's beautiful, I love it. And
well, it's the same story with the bar scene. I think what's in the film works great. It works beautifully to picture, but musically, there's one version along the way that just for me was where I loved it. And so it's like, I retain that as something that I value that I created musically, but I fully agree and also defer, to the director. I mean, the same exact can be said for the bar scene in Knuckle Draggers, where I really love the cue that's there. I mean, I loved the cue even before the cue that was there where Amin was chanting and it was totally ridiculous. And so over the top. The way that was scored, you would think that Ross was about to rip their skull open and start eating their brains, but it was so awesome. And
sometimes the score needs 5% more love.
Yeah, exactly. 5% more love. Our favorite quote from a director who I guess probably
just
should
tell
remain.
Them. Just tell them. 5%. All of these things can be covered by 5% more love.
Yeah.
What the hell is that from?
Night That's summer. From the behind the scenes on Signs.
Oh, okay.
Where you can, just keep it 5% more love.
You can see
just in Howard Rowling's eyes. Yes, okay.
You can see it. They're on the scoring stage at Taddeo, and there's like a 100 million piece orchestra and James Newton Howard. Like the orchestra's not quite together, is what it is. They're doing a big, busy scene, and the orchestra's still, you know, these guys are the best musicians in the world, but when you write something as intricate as that score, sometimes you have to do it 2-3 times before it's really perfect.
Is that Signs?
Yeah. And so they're doing the whole big ending thing with all the, and it's going crazy. And James Newton Howard is on the talk back with Pete Anthony, and he's like, you know, it's almost there. They just need to do it again. There's no one problem with the performance. It just needs to be. And M. Night Shyamalan keeps trying to take the talk back away from him and say, just tell them 5% more love. Just tell them. And James Newton Howard's like, oh, they just need to do it again. Just tell them 5% more love. No, they really just need to do it again. And he's like, then James Newton Howard, like, you see his shoulders drop. And he goes,
The note is
5% more love. And M. Night Shyamalan's like, ha, 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 ha. I'll get it. And of course, the thing is, the orchestra hears that, and then they play it perfectly again. And M. Night James Newton Howard knows that they just needed to do it one more time. And M. Night Shyamalan, meanwhile, is thinking, I did it! I did it!
Great director.
Yeah, so that's the kind of notes these guys like to give.
Oh, yeah. I think very simply the most gratifying. I mean, I already sort of described my amazing fuck yeah moment with Austin. But I think just simply put, the most gratifying moment is when the score works with the picture. You know? Like when you just, you hear it, you see it, and you're like, yes, it works. Yeah. This is it. Because, I mean, not only is there kind of an energizing effect it has, but also there's just a massive sense of relief. And when you're, you know, in post-production, that's like, that's the greatest feeling ever, because you're so tightly wound at that point.
And
know?
Yeah, for me, it's like, it can't just be each scene. It's like, each cue works, each scene works.
Yeah.
You've got to get the whole thing. And it's like sitting home alone in front of the TV watching the final product, and it's like, done. That's the best part of working with the composer, when it's like, okay, Austin, we're done.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, for me specifically, there are some scenes in Amrad where there's no dialogue. And the music the scene wouldn't work without the music. Not because it's not working, but because it's written for the music to carry subtext. That's
it was
not
designed
there.
Around
like
music.
When the kids put their hands out the window, you need the music to tell the story emotionally. Without the music, it wouldn't work. It would be just kids putting their hands out the window. So it's about the innocence of childhood, and then the music. When it works, you feel the bass, you know, you feel gutturally the bass playing that, and then you hear it. The fuck yeah moment is great, but then when you hear it with the audience and you hear the audience respond to the moment, that's where the real fuck yeah is. Like, they're really connecting with this. They're like remembering their childhood, whatever it is, and it's because of the music. Married to the image. It's not because of one element isolated from the other.
I can really relate to that with Knuckle Draggers at its premiere, because that was the first sort of comedy like that that I had ever done, where it was like very kind of like a, it was like a traditional romantic comedy, you know, very sort of but spun, you know, spun in its content, but like the structure, you know, I was dealing with what one typically has to deal with on that kind of film, which is it's very song driven, and my job is to just make a few specific scenes really come to life in their own way and tell the story in that. And so many of the films have been dramas or dark. I mean, and 3 Day Weekend is like one of these films that is sort of halfway in between, and really so is Yuletide, where there are not just like straight up comedies where every scene is there to make you, you know, laugh basically, but they're like more sort of drama intermingled, and it's not quite so consistently comedic, despite the fact that Knuckle Draggers like makes me cry at the end every time. It's very much comedy driven, more so than any other thing I had done. And for me, that moment was at the premiere, like Amin said, seeing it with an audience, where the lunch money scene, the music started and everyone started laughing because it called so much attention to Paul's face and his reaction to the actor. It calls so much attention to his facial expression, which, you know, was, of course, like, what we were trying to do, but I hadn't really, like, I didn't make myself laugh doing it. I just felt like this is what it needs. And then seeing it with an audience where everyone suddenly burst out laughing, I was like, holy shit, I'm funny. It's beautiful. it was really, actually, that was crazy to me. And the same thing at the end with the pitch, where the music, there's, like, these three short little cues that are each, like, 10 seconds long that come in succession. You know, there's, like, a cue and then a little bit of dialogue and then a cue and then a little bit of dialogue. And it's, like, this little kind of vignette towards the end of the film where it was the same thing, where the audience was, like, really responding. And I could feel that the music was playing a larger part of that than I had ever really thought.
Yeah, there's actually a friend of mine who had seen a rough cut of the film like 6 months before that did not have any music right there in that scene. And that scene didn't change in that time. He actually noted, he said, oh, you know, I really like, you know, the music you guys put in there, and it worked really well. So it's funny that you felt it, because he that's what he said.
Yeah, that there was something about the audience. Same, and I mean, and Grace also, like, the visceral experience of that film
with
an audience.
Birth, I think, yeah. I mean, we premiered at Sundance this last Sundance, and we had two guys pass out at our premiere. And there's nothing more gratifying. I mean, you know, like comedy and horror, very precise. If people don't laugh, you didn't do your comedy right. If people aren't, they don't need to pass out necessarily, but if people aren't, you know, you need to feel them squirm. You could definitely feel that in the room.
Yeah, it was. It's electric, and I have a very hard time thoroughly enjoying these premieres. I find that my body temperature goes way down for some reason, and I'm like my hands are like ice, because I'm just so aware of what's going on around me, and I'm like I become this just super hypersensitive.
You were nervous, man.
And I know. I mean, nothing was. Alex's introductory speech at the Knuckle Draggers premiere was the best I've ever heard. He goes, "Can anyone please raise their hand if there's an open seat next to them?" And then he goes and sits down.
And I did sit down. There were no seats. I was trying to find a seat for my date. It was cool. It was full, so I was happy. But
it was the funniest thing. Then he just leaves. Like he just like very like he was so like tunnel vision like just
well we were also waiting for one of the cast members who what's called
yeah it
that was the best
traffic.
Speech though I have to say
well it was hilarious and so yeah that audience reaction I mean you know obviously they're not listening to the music but there are a few moments
so. Yeah.
Yeah every film typically has its one scene. That the audience, like if I go to the premiere and it's like revealed, you know, if like I go up for a Q&A or something and people realize I'm the composer, there's almost always one scene. I can almost always predict with each film what it'll be, where someone comes up to me and they're like, "Oh my God, I really like the birth scene," or also the time lapse scene in Grace, or the hands out the window, or like the revelation sequence in Back Soon, and then certainly the dating scene, and then the couch scene. Like those are those moments where the music gets to kind of, you know, like those are those magic moments for me at least, and usually also with you guys and but there's nothing like that with an audience where you're people who've never experienced it before and you know they're really like the reacting and when it goes well, like you said, horror and comedy are the two where it's most immediately obvious if you've done your job, whereas you know Abu Red. We had like such wide ranges of audiences.
You feel the emotion.
You can feel it, but it's
with Abraid, which is a drama. You feel, but there's humor throughout it, and you know you have a gauge of when the audience, how involved the audience is from the laughter. You see how involved they are in the drama, and then you have
the most dramatically intense reactions. I guess were ones where for the first half of the film they're laughing at scenes that were not even really supposed to be laughed at, but they're so like emotionally unhinged that their nervous laughter is like explosive.
Yeah,
like
I mean, the range is all over the place, but
I remember like at the premiere in Amman, that audience was so juiced for that movie,
yeah.
And they were laughing like they, I couldn't even hear half the movie. Like
I
you know,
they
it's
were
like
proud, they were more proud that there's a
of course
that's not like your typical audience, but like
no, not
you're
at
right,
all. But
you can really gauge from the laughter or the squirming, like what kind of reaction.
Well, I really appreciate the time that you've given me today. This has been a blast. I have had so much fun with this. If you could see me, I have just been smiling from this end. Well, I have been. I've really, really enjoyed this, and it's fantastic that you were able to come together today to talk about
last little thing.
Certainly.
Knuckle Draggers, for anybody in the Toronto area, Knuckle Draggers is having its Canadian premiere at the Real Heart Film Festival on Saturday, June 27th, for anybody who wants to see it.
Yeah, we're going to actually be at Fantasia in Montreal. I don't know when that is. I think it's July something. But that's our Canadian premiere, too, for Grace.
Awesome. Anybody would like to buy the rights to distribute a movie called Prince? we are open for that. Or if you would just like to show it somewhere, I could make that happen too.
They'll be all over that on the FSM message board.
Please, yes.
And Make the Yuletide Gay is doing festivals all over this summer, and it's going to be out on DVD for Christmas. And the soundtrack will be out very soon with some of Austin's score, and you can also get the soundtrack for 3-day weekend back soon with Austin's score
on Amazon and iTunes.
Both of which have iTunes reviews by Amin, which I wrote.
And actually, Captain Amirad's score comes out in, what is it, June?
It comes out soon, yeah.
Yeah, so is it like 35 minutes of, 40 minutes
yeah,
of score?
Yeah, it's like a 35, 40 minutes.
Yeah, score. Big orchestral score for all the fans who love big orchestra. This is the score to get. Score of the year.
Oh, if anybody is listening for the St. John's Women's Film Festival, which is, I believe is a Canadian film festival, you should pick Print. There we go.
St. John's.
Yeah, I know. Wouldn't it be like St. Jones, you'd think? I will not criticize their name. It's their lovely festival, and they need to accept me. You don't need to put that in.
This is where the music fades up.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to end off the program by saying that's all for us this week. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I'd like to thank all my guests for bringing this first on Visions and Sound, making it a fun and fantastic experience. And a big thank you to you, Austin, for suggesting this program and for bringing everybody together today.
Well, and congratulations on a 9-year anniversary. I mean, you know, this.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
How many listeners do you have?
Can we clap into the mic or no?
Yeah, it might distort a little, but we will applaud.
FM 98.5. And welcome back to Visions in Sound. My name is Rob Daniels. Yeah, fantastic. 90 minutes of great, great stuff. And especially if you're a film music fan or a fan of independent film, this is one of those opportunities that came along maybe once, twice in a lifetime, and I'm hoping that I'll be able to do more of this kind of thing in the future. So if you have any suggestions for topics to cover during the another roundtable that I'll do, then by all means you can contact me at visionsinthesound2000@hotmail.com. This doesn't necessarily have to do with film music. It can deal with a more broader subject like just film, TV music. Like I was thinking of for another project, and I've spoken to two composers in the past little while. And if you're a regular listener of the show, you would have heard those two composers talk about the lack of originality in today's film music, film and TV music. So, it might be something to consider. Anyway, so like I said, if you're interested in any of the film, television, or video game music that I play, or if you're interested in suggesting a topic, by all means, contact me at visionsinsound2000@hotmail.com. We're celebrating 9 years on the air, and I mentioned a special treat that I would throw in as well. Here is some music from the film Grace. Now, this is music that you won't necessarily hear in the film, as it was written before and was used to sort of help the actors get a feel for their roles and the film itself. So this is kind of an unusual take. It's the score, but it's not the score by Austin Wintry. So have a listen here, and I'll be back to wrap up the show in just a little bit. But here's some music from Grace. Thank you. And with a little bit of the score to grace, that's music by Austin Wintry. Now, again, that was music that was done for the film, but was based on the script and were used to help the actors understand the feeling of each scene. Now, I didn't get into the whole sort of background of or so the whole music there, but it kind of gives you an idea. Now I'm going to play just a little bit of the actual score itself, and then give you, you can sort of compare and contrast the two. And then I'll be back in just a little bit to sort of wrap up the show. But here is just a little bit of music from the actual soundtrack to Grease. Now, this is also, I'm going to put it out here that this should get a release. It's just one of those scores that's really cool. Like when I first heard it, I'm sitting there and I'm just really getting, I don't know, really getting creeped out. I mean, they mentioned during the round table that two guys passed out at the premiere. Well, have a listen here and you can sort of see why. So, like I said, I'll be back. I'm going to play a little bit of the score to Grease, and then I'll be back to sort of wrap up the show in just a little bit. So here's some music from Grease. They mentioned it a few times during our round table discussion. So I'll be back in just a little bit. We'll be right back. From the film Grace. Well, that's it for me this week. I hope you've enjoyed the music that was played here on the show. If you liked any of the music you heard on today's show, Austin tells me that Back Soon and 3-Day Weekend, the Rob Williams films, are both available on his label T65B Records, and that's on Amazon as well as iTunes. Make the Yuletide Gay is being released similarly by the production company for the film as a song/score album, and BSX Records, you've heard me mention them a few times on the show, is actually releasing Captain Abu Raed this summer. So be watching for those. And I do get a lot of requests, actually, for Captain Abu Raed, as I played it on the show back in March. I'll get an email every once in a while. You know, that music that you played, what was that? And, I go into the explanation, and they are really disappointed when they find out that there's not a score release. Well, thank goodness there is finally going to be a score release for it. So, just to hold you over until then, here's a little bit of music from Captain Abu Raed. And I'll be back next week with more Visions in Sound. But I'd also like to thank Austin as well as Skype Communications Program, the people who developed that, without which this 9th anniversary show would not have been possible. I would not have been able to talk to 5 directors on the other side of the continent, basically. Really appreciate that. Anyway, so I'll be back next week with more Visions and Sound. I'm going to leave you with a little bit of the Captain Abu Raed score. Oh.